The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm here interviewing Rick Wilson, the director of the International Human Rights Clinic at American University, Washington College of Law. And we're here to talk about his representation of Omar Khadr in Guantanamo Bay. Rick, how long have you been representing Omar, and what's his current status?
Well, I began his representation together with Professor Munir Ahmed from here at the law school in July of 2004, about a month after the Supreme Court decided the Rasool case that said that detainees had rights in the U.S. courts that they could enforce. So our first visit with him took some time because the government resisted in many different ways our efforts to try to gain physical access to him, including requirements that we obtain FBI security clearances to see classified information, a protective order that was put into place at their request by Judge Green in a collection of cases that were pending then in the district courts after the Rasool decision, about 20 lawyers and about a dozen detainees, a hardy band of the first individuals who were trying to get access to the base to visit with clients and get into the courts to litigate the claims, which were in the posture of habeas corpus petitions. So our first visit, as I said, was in November, and we've visited with him regularly every month or so ever since that time.
Now, he's been in custody for more than 5 years. He was arrested in Afghanistan, is that right?
He was picked up by American forces together with Northern Alliance forces in Afghanistan in July of 2002. He was wounded severely during that the conflict that gave rise to his capture, and was evacuated to Bagram Air Force Base outside of Kabul, where he was kept for several months. And almost immediately after his arrival there, he began to be interrogated. Days after he arrived, they carried him on a stretcher into an interrogation room and began interrogating him.
And when he was picked up, he was only 15 years old?
He was only 15. He is a Canadian citizen and had moved with his family to Kabul because of his father's involvement in work with refugee families that had begun during the time of Soviet occupation. His father had worked with Afghan orphan children, and it opened a series of orphanages that ran along the road from Kabul into Pakistan. And he was separated from his family and was captured in July of 2002.
And he is now being held in Guantanamo and has now been charged by the U.S. military, is that correct?
That's correct. There is this special kind of tribunal called a military commission, which hasn't operated in this country since World War II, that is designed to try individuals charged with war crimes that occur during a period of time when these are the only option viable. And it's been the position of the administration that this is the only option for his treatment. In a sense, he's among the luckier of the 450 individuals who are still held at Guantanamo Bay. He's one of 10 who have charges against them. And I use the term lucky in a kind of mixed sense, because at the very least, he knows that he is charged with some kind of misconduct. The remaining 440 plus, including these most recent 14 high-value detainees who were taken from secret detention centers somewhere in the world and announced by the president in mid-September that they would be taken to Guantanamo for trial. Those individuals haven't been charged with anything. They haven't been convicted of anything. They've all been determined to be enemy combatants through a process that purports to look like it complies with the Geneva Conventions. But one of our central arguments in the habeas corpus process is that that process doesn't comport with even the most minimal rules of constitutional due process, an issue that's still pending in the courts, lo these many years after their arrival there.
What is he actually charged with?
He was charged with four crimes, and I'll list them, but I do this with great caution in the sense that I believe because of the decision of the Supreme Court in July or in late June of this year, in the Hamdan case, Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, came down right at the end of their term, that struck down the military commissions. They also said a good deal about what crimes could be charged. And they took a very skeptical view of one of the charges that is common to all 10 detainees, and that's the charge of conspiracy. They did a historical analysis of conspiracy and concluded that it was not a war crime susceptible to prosecution by a military commission. If that analysis is true, we believe that all of the crimes of which Omar is charged are not susceptible to trial as war crimes. He was charged with conspiracy, as were all the other nine. He was also charged with aiding the enemy, something that has been changed radically in its configuration in the new legislation that just passed last week, the Military Commissions Act of 2006.
Which passed Congress at the end of September, beginning of October.
Just a week or two ago.
Right.
And he was also charged with murder by an unprivileged belligerent and attempt murder by an unprivileged belligerent. Those are the terms of art. The murder charge arises from the death of an American soldier during the conflict in which he was captured, and the attempt murder is grounded in similar kinds of activities that arise from his conduct prior to his capture.
Now, correct me if I get this wrong, but as I understand it, in the time that you have been involved in this, or maybe just before you began to represent him, we've sort of gone from it not being clear that anyone at Guantanamo even had any right to claim to see a lawyer or to get into a United States court of law at all whatsoever, mm-hmm. to now acknowledging that there is a right to have access to a lawyer, but we're still arguing over what rights mm-hmm. those lawyers can assert on behalf of mm-hmm. the prisoners at Guantanamo?
That's accurate. I think even at bottom, I think your description of the sort of advance in the law is pretty accurate. The major victory of counsel after all of the litigation that has taken place in the federal courts in the United States has been to gain access by lawyers to these individuals under the most rigorous of security conditions. So the protective order that I mentioned before includes a series of limitations on visits, an assumption that all client communications are classified and have to be screened by a privileged team of experts who are on terrorism, who make a decision as to whether or not it contains coded messages before it can be released to the public, etc. So the bottom line, though, is that these individuals are still waiting for a definitive decision from a court in the United States that says that they have rights. And the government's decision, and I don't think I'm being overly simplistic here, is that at least as far as what the Rasool decision says, that is that these individuals have the right to access to the courts, they don't disagree, but they say once they arrive at the courts, they have no enforceable rights to call on. So that's the government's persistent position. It's a position that was disagreed with by Judge Green, the case in the cluster of cases that we were involved with, and that was agreed with by Judge Leon in a decision about 2 weeks separated from her decision. Those two cases have been consolidated and are pending now at the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia under the case name of Al-Oda, who is one of the Kuwaiti detainees who is there. And so about 30 of those detainees are pressing forward with a claim that has been briefed and rebriefed and rebriefed and rebriefed. And I literally mean
that. But this not is yet the, argued?
It has been argued has orally been. In September of last year, but it was rebriefed after the Detainee Treatment Act passed. It was rebriefed after, and that act passed in late December 2005. It was rebriefed after the Hamdan decision, and we're assuming it will be rebriefed after the Military Commissions Act of 2006, which, of course, is not limited to the use of military commissions because of its very, very important aspect of it, the habeas stripping provisions that basically eliminate any right to access to the courts or purport to for all of the 450 detainees who are there.
So as I've heard you and some of your colleagues say, I think in other settings, where we seem to be is that you have a right to counsel, you just don't have any rights for which that counsel can actually represent you.
That's the government's version. And to date, since our first entry of appearance in this case in July of 2002, that position has prevailed. We're still stuck in the quicksand of the arguments about rights of detainees.
Now, it has to be relatively mind-boggling, I think, to be involved in a matter in which, in one form or another, the Supreme Court has now issued four separate full-blown rulings over a period of 3 years,
mm-hmm.
and yet you have no more knowledge, if I'm correct, about what is likely to happen to your client, what kind of process he may face, and when, than 3 years ago.
In a legal sense, I think that's absolutely true. In a political sense, I think the landscape has shifted fairly significantly. I think a lot of people in the American public have been educated about this administration's views with regard to the use of military commissions, with regard to the use of evidence obtained by torture. And I think actually large numbers, large percentages of the American public disagree with this administration's policy. In part, I think that's because the lawyers who have visited these detainees and brought their stories out are really the only link to the reality of what these individuals are suffering. And it's a way to educate the American public about their situation. So the crucial access to lawyers makes a huge difference. I think it also makes a difference in our case because Omar is Canadian. And while the Canadian government has been silent thus far, they've chosen to defer to the United States as a strong ally, to make the right choices, to do the right thing in the prosecution of terrorist cases. But they're running out of patience, I think. And so we have some hope. I think on the political front, both in terms of the shifting public opinion and in terms of Canadian the administration in Canada, that they will eventually lose patience, and even if he were to go to trial and be convicted, that Canada could at some point along the way weigh in and come to bat for him. And at bottom, as you mentioned earlier at the outset of this conversation, we are talking about a boy who has grown into a man. And the single most important fact, we believe, is that a child of his age has never been prosecuted in modern history, certainly since the time of the Nuremberg trials, right after World War II. No country and no international tribunal has tried a child for war crimes in modern history. So we hope that that example is a way of showing the United States government that it's making the wrong choice with regard to not only Omar, but all the detainees.
When we've talked about this before, I was fascinated by the mechanics or logistics of what you had to do to get to see your client. Can you talk a little bit about how that works now?
Well, it's kind of interesting. I think I described to you this elaborate process of visits as habeas counsel that is sort of festooned with the rules about getting permission from the government, your party opponent, to go to visit the base, and they basically hold the lever to let lawyers in or out. So you can't even fly into Guantanamo without military orders that have to start by a request to the Justice Department, who is our party opponent in that litigation. And the series of rigorous and sometimes incredibly difficult rules that make communication with clients through visits or through correspondence an extremely slow process, a process of mail that can take 2 months in transit from one end to the other and back. Ironically, in an effort, I think, to show that their process is full and fair, as that's the term they seem to tout a great deal in public, since he was charged by military commission, and since Professor Ahmed and I volunteered to serve as civilian defense counsel, now we can fly at least part of the way on regular routine military aircraft that go in and out of the base with all of the people who live there or work there on particular stays. And once we arrive, we go directly to the side of the bay where the detainees are held, and we have a vehicle, a cell phone, identity cards that allow us access anywhere on the base. We're not required to have an escort, and we stay in what could only be described as better housing than what we had before. I'm not sure it's good, but it's better than what one has when you stay in the bachelor's quarters on the other side of the bay. So it's
you no longer need a military escort to meet
right.
When you meet with him?
That's right. You get off the ferry and there's a vehicle waiting there. And the military folks who administer the military commissions there have stayed in place basically even after the Hamdan decision on the assumption that they will resume again. So they've been incredibly good about facilitating our travel, our arrival, our housing, all the issues that need to happen. So it's a little less expensive, it's a little less onerous, it doesn't have all of the baggage of the protective order that goes with turning over your notes to an escort who puts them in a sealed envelope and sends them to a secure facility. So it looks a little more like a standard attorney-client relationship, except that you have to fly to Cuba to have that relationship at all.
What do you think the outlook is? We've got a couple minutes left here, and I guess I wonder where are we headed, either specifically with Omar or more generally with the process for the whole group being held at Guantanamo?
Well, I think the president has had to bend to the will of the growing voices from some within his own camp who have called for Guantanamo to be closed. He said publicly that Guantanamo should be closed. But I think his actions in shifting ground recently about the Military Commissions Act and his taking these high-value detainees there indicate that it will be closed if he follows his promise or commitment to do that. Only for certain individuals. There have been plans in the making for some time that indicate that up to 150 of the 400 and plus are pending release and return to their home countries. But that still leaves a fairly significant number. And whether or not those individuals could be charged and tried and convicted is a serious, serious legal question, aside from the political aspects of it, because of the time that has passed. The Military Commissions Act, which purports to put into place a commission system that complies with the Hamdan decision, I'm afraid is the replacement of one broken system with another broken system. This is really no better.
And has already been challenged
It has, I think.
As soon as it was passed.
Exactly. And I think there will be a number of additional challenges by those of us who are continuing to represent detainees in the military commissions process. For Omar, though, I think one of the more subtle aspects of the Supreme Court decision in Hamdan was its assumption that there was no need for speed because there was an underlying basis for holding these individuals at Guantanamo, that they were detainees in a war that could be held until the termination of hostilities. That's the language that the majority uses and pretty much assumes as a basis for justifying their ongoing detention. If that's true, the question is, what hostilities and for how long?
How will we know when they're over?
Right. If this is the war on terrorism, as any lawyer who knows anything about humanitarian law would say, that's not a war against a country, it's a war against an idea. And the idea will be there, and so the war will never end. If it is against Afghanistan, which is where we originally intervened and where Omar was captured, I think there are very good legal arguments to suggest that the hostilities were over when the Karzai government took office before he was captured. So that would make a huge legal difference and is an issue that yet again has not been litigated, as so many issues around war have not been handled at all by the courts in the United States.
A final quick question. What role have American University law students been able to play in this process?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. We've had students involved in this case. I think our dream when we took the case back in July of 2002 was to have this be a student case like any other student case, that students would go to Guantanamo and visit with the client and we would watch them do their work from a distance as their supervisors. It took us about 10 minutes to figure out that wasn't going to be the way that things worked and that only lawyers with security clearances would be allowed to go there. In fact, the Justice Department early on denied any request by us to process student security clearances during the time they're with us. So that hasn't, however, kept them from being involved. We have a two-track strategy here. We have a domestic litigation and we have international litigation going on. So we have a case pending, a series of cases that have been pending in the Inter-American Human Rights System with its headquarters here in Washington that tracks a case for the protection of all the Guantanamo detainees, and then we will file this fall a petition on behalf of Omar himself seeking his protection through international human rights law. And those decisions are, although not enforceable in a U.S. court, they have a strong sort of moral weight to them, and I think they contribute to that public education that I was talking about earlier. Students send Omar letters routinely. We're pursuing FOIA litigation, that is Freedom of Information Act, petitions to several different departments to obtain as much information as we can get. And in several other respects, students have been key researchers on this. We even had a subcontract with a clinic at the University of Virginia who did an amazing job for us last year on issues about the history of the prosecution of children for war crimes. So that was one of the rare collaborations where we had one clinic working with another clinic to produce research on these issues. So it's an amazing network of folks who have come out to help on this, and the students have played a key role.
Thank you, Professor Rick Wilson. This has been quite fascinating, and I hope we'll get to talk about this again in the future.